Good morning. Good morning. I am so happy to be here with you. I was, you guys had a good night's sleep, and I did not. I went to bed late, a little nervous, wringing my hands about this morning, and then I look at you, and I'm like, why? These are my friends. And then I popped up this morning thinking, where's that 6:30 in the morning meeting? Did anybody else miss it? No. I kind of liked it. We could come with our cap and our morning breath and our blankets and kind of have morning devotional time together. And it would be like we'd have those aha moments in unison. There was something special about that time. But so it feels a little weird being the first meeting of the day. But welcome, and yeah, let's begin. I also need to tell you guys that I gave my titles way in advance, thinking I'll have time to prepare for camp meeting. But I changed everything, so if you can kind of disregard the titles, we'll try to fit it in somewhere, but yeah, they've all changed, so hope that doesn't mess everybody up too much. So it was October 1911, and two men set out to be the first ones to reach the South Pole. They represented two completely different nations. They were two completely different men. They had two completely different strategies of how they were going to accomplish this, but they set out at the same time. Both of them had similar backgrounds in terms of they had been explorers and they had braved a lot of new and exciting areas of the world. One was from Great Britain, and that was Scott, and the other one was Amundsen from Norway. There they were, leaders of their expedition, about the same age, hovering around 40 years old. Neither of them had cell phones. Neither of them had radios. Neither of them had satellite links. This was 1911. But off they went. One of them was to lead their group to total victory. They'd plant their flag. They'd make it back to their boats. They'd sail back to their country. No casualties. Success, glory. The other one was to lead his men there, but they never made it back. They experienced this slow, lingering death, frostbite, hunger, freezing to death, found sometime later, their bodies, their notes. What made the difference? So Amundsen from Norway had kind of been training his whole life. He wanted to see what his body was capable of doing. If I was stranded in the ocean, could I live off dolphin meat? Well, let's see. So then he would do that. He'd push his body physically. He did explorations here in America to see again what it would be like, what was his body capable of. And he trained himself. In anticipation of going to the South Pole, he said, I'm going to go check out the people who know how to live in sub-zero weather all the time. So he went and visited the Eskimos, and there he observed how they lived. He saw that when they moved, it wasn't with rapid, woo, erratic movements like I do, naturally. Sometimes you ever observe yourself later and think, why am I like that? And then you look at your parents and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. So anyway, I have erratic movements, and he saw that the Eskimos don't. They were just slow, steady, never trying to break a sweat because the sweat could freeze on their bodies. And he saw that the clothing they wore was animal skins, and that was loose, so that if they did sweat, you know, it'd be more capable of breathing, of evaporating. He saw what they ate. He saw that they used dogs. And he took all that information into his brain as he thought about his own exploration to the South Pole. So he did choose dogs, and he got a lot of flack for it, and this is what he said. The English have loudly and openly told the world that skis and dogs are unusable in these regions and that fur clothes are rubbish. We shall see. We shall see. And that is what he ended up using. He thought, hey, I'll take dogs, and if I run out of food for the dogs, dogs eat meat. I can kill one dog and feed it to the rest of the dogs, and they'll be able to survive. He thought of that. Scott, on the other hand, took donkeys. What do donkeys eat? Where's the grass, right? But he took donkeys. Amundsen took 3 tons of supplies. Talk about being overly prepared. And this guy was amazing because he would anticipate everything that could go wrong. He thought it through in his mind. How can I prepare for that in advance? How can I, you know, gather things and be ready and not be a victim to circumstances? And so he set up these supply depots along his route, and he set up 20 flags. He had his men traveling 10 kilometers around these depots, setting up flags so that if in a storm he got off course, he'd be able to find one of these flags and know, oh, okay, I'm close, and be able to navigate his way back to the depots. And as he was traveling to the South Pole, he would set up these black flags every 8 miles, again, as waymarks to know how to get back. 3 tons of storage supplies, 4 thermometers that they use for altitude tests, something like that. Whereas you look at Scott, again, we mentioned the donkeys, he had 1 supply depot. That was it. If you missed that one, tough luck. No markings as he was traveling through. No way to say, oh, this is the way I came. He had 1 flag that he posted by his supply depot. He had 1 ton of storage supplies, and he took 1 thermometer. And guess what happened to that 1 thermometer? It broke. And I guess it's reported that he was pretty upset about it. But you get the idea that maybe Scott thought, nothing's going to happen to me. That's not going to happen to me. All those bad things that are happening maybe to everyone else, but not to me. So Scott did not go prepared. Amundsen's philosophy was, I may say that this is the greatest factor, the way in which the expedition is equipped. The way in which every difficulty is foreseen and precautions taken for meeting or avoiding it. Victory awaits him who has everything in order. Luck, people call it. Defeat is certain for him who has neglected to take the necessary precautions in time. And this is called bad luck. Scott's philosophy. It is more, this is what they found in his journals when he was writing. It is more than our share of ill fortune, how great may be the element of luck. What do you think? Neither of them knew exactly what lay ahead of them, right? They didn't know what the weather was going to be like on any given day or what the berries. No one had traversed this before. They were exploring uncharted territory. But one had tried to foresee the difficulties. The other one neglected a few things. So on December 15, 1911, it was Amundsen that was able to plant his Norwegian flag on the South Pole with his men. Was it luck? Was it fate? Was it destiny? Were all those precautions he took up just, whatever? He even took an extra, if he was to miss all of his little supply depots, he made sure that he was carried enough stuff that he could last for so many days even after that. You know, he thought things through very carefully. Some might say, oh, he was a sour Sally, or he was overly cautious, or you know how we kind of poo-poo people who maybe think pessimistically, and yet it served his advantage, didn't it? In a very big way. He was prepared and he was not going to become a victim. Well, I would like to say that you and I are on an expedition, and it's called life. And we don't know what's around the next corner exactly. We plan, we prepare, but all of us have experienced stuff in life that we didn't foresee completely, or that we were surprised. Really, that did happen to me. And you and I are leaders, not of a group of men, but of ourselves. And when it comes to your health, what do you think? Do you think, oh, it's up to my genes, it's up to how I was raised, my culture, what I have time for, what my doctor does or does not do for me, chance? These are all ways that we can think, but I would like, and they may work for or against you, but I would like to suggest that good leaders don't really lead in this way. Amundsen and Scott had dramatically different outcomes, and it's interesting, they had the same percentage of good weather days. You know, none of them was dealing with exceptional circumstances, but they did things differently. And I would like to inspire you today in this meeting that you and I have the ability to alter our trajectory. We do. Yeah, we have genes. Yeah, stuff happens. But I think that if we were to learn something from Amundsen and take charge and foresee things and try to learn from the Eskimos, maybe we can picture that today, that you're here to learn just a few things from the Eskimos, not everything. We're just going to throw out a few tidbits, but if you grab those tidbits and apply them to your life, they could make the difference in your ultimate success. What are we going to talk about? Heart disease. I am 45 years old, about to turn 46, and at 45, the lifetime heart disease risk for men is 60%. So 3 out of 5 men here at some point in your life will have some form of heart disease. For me, 55%. 1 out of 2 women in this crowd, according to statistics here in the United States of America, will experience some manifestation of heart disease. So what are the odds? Should I toss a coin and say, oh, there we go, I'm going to have a heart attack in my future? How do I grasp with this statistic? Now, I believe that the Bible means what it says when it says that time and chance happen to us all. I do. I think that time and chance, things just happen, and there's not always rhyme or reason. I believe God can bring everything, work everything together for good, but I believe in time and chance. But I also believe that we are to become masters of our circumstances. Masters, just like Amundsen was. What if we were to adopt his approach and hopefully practice the type of preventive medicine that Amundsen did, where we can prevent, postpone, where we gain tools and we apply them to our life? What would that be like? So here's a picture of blood vessels in your heart, right? Surrounding your heart, feeding your heart. And I've named them. I've dubbed the one on the left Scott, poor guy, and the one on the right Amundsen. Because you see the one on the left, that is a heart attack waiting to happen because that blood vessel is no longer full and thick. It's become constricted. It's become small. There's probably plaque buildup. It's become rigid. And like I said, a heart attack any day now. Loss of flexibility. The beginnings of this is what is called atherosclerosis. This is the development of plaque in the arteries. And you see there the first picture on the left, there we see this normal, beautiful blood vessel that's just been kind of sliced, and you can look down the lumen of it. And there's this lining around that lumen, and it's a lining that's composed of epithelial cells. It's called the epithelium. It's a very beautiful, important part of your blood cells. It protects it. It provides this smooth running area where the blood can just swoosh through it at intense pressures, and that epithelium, strong, healthy, beautifully maintained, is a healthy blood vessel. And then you see to the right, the next step is all of a sudden there's injury that takes place to that layer, to the epithelium. There's a tear that takes place, and when that injury occurs, then you set yourself up for atherosclerosis. That's when LDL cholesterol enters. It invades the wall, the lining of that blood vessel, and it goes through this process in which plaque develops. And then as you see, it gets more, the blood vessel can become more and more occluded until a blood clot flowing through, bam. And then you have heart attack, and then you have stroke, something to that effect. This endothelium is very, very important, and it is the first step of this process. So what causes damage to the arterial wall? Elevated levels of cholesterol and triglycerides in the blood. These are just things that have been established that medicine will look at and say, yes, we know that there's an association between this and damage to the endothelial wall. Elevated levels of cholesterol, triglycerides, high blood pressure, inflammation, diabetes, aging, which we can't do anything about that one, right? And cigarette smoking. And there's just another picture of that same process taking place. So the endothelium is really interesting because it produces this gas called nitric oxide. So these healthy endothelial cells produce nitric oxide, and nitric oxide is what allows the muscles surrounding those blood vessels to be able to dilate with the blood coming through. So it dilates those blood vessels and keeps them strong, healthy, and flexible. So here you see nitric oxide dilates blood vessels. It can reduce oxidation of LDL cholesterol, which that's what takes place. When the LDL cholesterol invades the blood vessel wall, it becomes oxidized, and then that's the next step for the atherosclerotic process. So nitric oxide does these wonderful things for us, but only healthy, wonderful endothelial cells produce it. So if you were to go to your doctor and you were to say, what is my risk of heart disease? They would draw your blood and they would look at your lipid profile and they would look at cholesterol levels. So here we see desirable levels, borderline levels, and levels that are considered high risk. 240 for cholesterol, borderline 200 to 239, desirable less than 200. Triglycerides, and then we hit the two that most people talk about, and that's the HDL cholesterol and the LDL cholesterol. LDL cholesterol is 60 to 130, considered desirable, borderline 130 to 159, high risk 160 to 189. Normally we get our blood work back and the numbers don't mean anything to us because we don't really know what to compare it to. But this is just what's considered normal. Now, it's well accepted that LDL plays a significant part in the initiation and in the progression of atherosclerosis. So that's a number that they want to see at a certain level come down. And then there's the HDL cholesterol that they actually want to see it going up. LDL takes the cholesterol to the blood vessel. HDL removes it and then takes it to the liver. So those are the two simplified functions of the two. HDL actually suppresses LDL accumulation, inflammation, oxidation, endothelial damage, and blood clot formation. How do we raise HDL? Yes, exercise. We're not here to talk about exercise, but good diet without exercise is like, you know, one arm without the other kind of thing. They two need to work together. So these levels of LDL and HDL, keeping them within their within good ranges is really super important. But the reality is that half of the people who die of heart attack have normal levels. They have normal LDL cholesterol. They say, well, I just went to the doctor, and they never had any indication that they were at high risk of heart disease. So what's the deal? Well, some people, if you were to ask Caldwell Esselstyn, I'm sure most of you know who he is. He's a physician, a cardiologist who's worked a lot with reversal. We'll be talking about him. But he will say those normals are not low enough. He explains how when they set up the normals, that they saw what was, you know, healthy and what where risk started increasing. But they said, you know, if we tell the people that it has to be down here, it's going to frustrate the public. They're not going to be able to achieve that, and so they'll throw in the towel. So we'll bring it up a little higher and make it doable for them. Well, you know what happened by making it doable for us is we get a false sense of security, and we realize, if we'd work, maybe just to get it, bring it a little better, then our risk would decrease dramatically. So that's one issue. The other one that I think is just as significant is that there's more than LDL and cholesterol and all that to do with your heart disease risk. Just reminded right now, when I first started school this last year, young man comes into the class, I'm meeting my classmates, and he just read China Study. He's not a Christian, but he's like so excited about eating a plant-based diet, which has been a little discouraged, I guess, in classes. But he was so enthusiastic and telling me what that food could do for this and this and this. And this was coming from me. I looked at him and I said, well, you know, food isn't everything. And he said, it's not. I was like, no, it's not. So cholesterol isn't everything, okay, when you're thinking about your heart disease risk. So that was the point of that slide. Caldwell Esselstyn says, my goal in his work that he's doing to prevent and to reverse heart disease, my goal was to achieve through plant-based nutrition and cholesterol-lowering drugs a serum cholesterol level less than 150 milligrams per deciliter. We saw that it was 200 or less, right? He's saying 150 or less, as is seen in cultures where coronary artery disease is virtually absent. Research shows that people with a total cholesterol that is consistently below 150 rarely have coronary disease. Prior to the study, Dr. Esselstyn's group had average total cholesterol levels of 237. The group now averages 145. That's dramatic, isn't it? LDL cholesterol levels are around 82. About 70% of the participants have experienced regression of their disease, meaning that the plaques appeared smaller and smaller on successive angiograms. pretty impressive what a plant-based diet can do for your heart. How does it work? Well, this is one of the ways in which you can lower your cholesterol, that a plant-based diet will work for you. So plant foods have fiber in them, right? And even nuts have a lot of fiber in them. And there's two main classifications of fiber, and then within those classifications, you have all these little family members of fiber. But these are the two main family headings. Soluble and insoluble. Insoluble is the kind that we think of when we want regularity, it's in whole wheat bread, that's the insoluble kind. Soluble is the kind that actually looks like a gel-like substance when you mix it with water. If you cook your oats or if you soak chia seeds, you're going to see a gel-like substance, and that is the presence of soluble fiber that is doing that. What does it do? It reduces cholesterol levels and it keeps blood sugar stable. Where is it found? Beans, fruits, and oats are some excellent sources of soluble fiber. So how does soluble fiber work to accomplish lowering your cholesterol levels? So when you ingest soluble fiber and it's going through your digestive tract and there it is in your intestines, it sees the remnants, the used up bile. Bile is something that your gallbladder excretes into your intestine to help digest fats, a very important part of digestion. And fat is a very important nutrient that we all need to be eating. So it's digesting fat, and bile happens to be made out of cholesterol. So normally, that bile is then reabsorbed. Once it's done its job of breaking the fat down, then it's recycled, it's reabsorbed from your intestines back into your bloodstream, goes back into your liver, and your liver is going to recirculate that bile, which is made out of cholesterol, okay? But if you ingest soluble fiber and you keep ingesting soluble fiber, that soluble fiber grabs onto bile and says, "You're with me," and they go out in the wash together. So the liver's like, "What happened to all that bile? I better make some more." So it goes to your bloodstream, and what's it going to take from your bloodstream to make bile? Cholesterol. So it's going to take cholesterol from your bloodstream, and it's going to make more bile. And there it goes, and the cycle continues. As you keep ingesting your soluble fiber, you're going to be gradually, don't expect this overnight, reducing your cholesterol. This is how food can work for us. It's pretty interesting, pretty amazing how we could work. So if you guys were to ask your wives, "Hey, honey, what's for breakfast?" And she says, "Oats." You know what you say? All right. We're having oats for breakfast. If you guys don't like oats, try another form of soluble fiber, chia seeds, okay? I was encouraging people, throw chia seeds in some milk. I found this recipe online. You make like, you put it in your fridge the night before. It's the easiest thing in the world. Take it out in the morning, and it's just your little chia seed pudding. It's kind of like tapioca, but it's, you don't have to cook it or anything. And there you have some soluble fiber that you're taking in on a daily basis. All right, and if you ask your wife, "Honey, what's for lunch?" And she says, "Beans." You know what you say? Bring it on, right? Bring on the beans. And if you guys don't like beans, the way they are, just, you know, like beans, then get creative. That's a black bean burger that I saw a picture of, and I thought, that looks pretty good. So yeah, work for yourself in that way and gradually be helping to restore your lipid profiles to a more healthy level. Another advantage of just eating plant-based, this is going meatless, gives vegetarians, and these are lacto-ovo-vegetarians, a 32% lower heart disease risk than non-vegetarians. This was found in the EPIC Oxford study that's being conducted in England. And one of the factors is that when you're on a vegetarian diet, you're ingesting less saturated fat. And saturated fat is the single greatest dietary factor in the production of cholesterol. So something that we don't think about, even as vegetarians, we're like, "Well, I'm not eating cholesterol, and I've lowered my saturated fat, but my triglycerides are still high. What's going on?" And sometimes we neglect this little precious part of our lives, and that is that too much sugar can also elevate triglycerides. Now, I'm all for a good dessert, and please make it taste good, because if you're going to eat sugar, you might as well taste good, right? But it's not breakfast, lunch, and supper. It's not every day. The way that we're eating sugar in this country is out of control, right? And as a result, it's affecting your blood. And it's affecting these blood levels that will increase your risk for heart disease. Inflammation is another huge factor when it comes to cardiovascular disease. And as you can see from this slide, it is foundational to many other disease processes as well. But cardiovascular disease is a big one. And here we see atherosclerosis being defined as an inflammatory disease because inflammation is present when the damage to that beautiful lining that surrounds our blood vessels occurs. So here you see LDL cholesterol invading the endothelium, but you see inflammation being a precursor there as well. It's a precursor, but then also this plaque development causes and you create this vicious cycle of inflammation, which can be very damaging to our body. How can we know if our bodies are in a state of chronic inflammation? Well, you get your blood drawn again. And they measure these two levels, CRP, C-reactive protein, and homocysteine. I'm sure you've heard of those two levels before, but they indicate the level of inflammation. You want to bring these babies down. So you look at the CRP value, less than one, you're at low risk for cardiovascular disease. 1 to 3, average risk, and greater than 3, you're at high risk. These numbers, your CRP has been found to be an independent risk factor for heart disease, meaning if your LDL was normal and your cholesterol was looking great, but you had high CRP levels, again, you're increasing your chance of heart disease risk, even if your cholesterol levels are down, that you can have a false sense of security if those CRP levels are elevated. Homocysteine to the right, we see here the same thing. As homocysteine increases, so does your risk for heart disease quite dramatically. How do we get elevated homocysteine levels? Well, you may be someone who says, you know, I'm going to prevent heart disease. I'm going to eat a plant-based diet. I'm not going to eat any forms of cholesterol. I'm going to lower my saturated fat. But guess what? If your vitamin B12 levels are low, your homocysteine levels are high. It's just the way the body works. And so vitamin B12 supplementation is extremely important when it comes to preventing heart disease. How about elevated CRP? Infection, obesity, smoking, high blood pressure, cancer, autoimmune disease, low antioxidant ingestion. Antioxidants, we get those from fruits and vegetables and plant foods. Excess iron. Excess iron is something that a lot of men in this country can be in danger of who eat a lot of meat, red meat. They eat the hemi form of iron. They don't bleed like women do, and so they can have an excess buildup, which can actually elevate these CRP levels. Then omega-3 deficiency can also increase inflammation. So your omega-3s are going to be found in your flax seeds and in your chia seeds, but the plant sources of omega-3 So omega-3 is, again, a family name, and we have three different family members. And vegetarian sources of omega-3 are really rich in two of the family members, but not in one of them. Guess what's rich in this other one? Fish. But guess where the fish get their omega-3 from? Algae. Have you guys read my article? I love it. Thank you. Okay, so get your DHA from all of those sources, and you'll be bringing those CRP levels hopefully lower. High insulin, high blood sugar, gum disease, stress, lack of sleep, chronic pain, allergies, life, it seems like, right, can raise inflammation CRP levels. Here also we see that elevated blood sugars does increase damage to that endothelial layer in your blood vessels. Low vitamin D, we mentioned omega-3. Vitamin D is really important. A low value of that in your blood also can increase damage to the blood vessels. So I want to talk about phytochemicals. All plants have phytochemicals. That's the term. Phyto is plant, chemicals. You're not going to find this in dairy or meat because it's not a plant, right? Phytochemicals, just what the name sounds. The plant develops these chemicals as it has to protect itself against the environment. It has to protect itself against, you know, the intensity of the sun, against possible drought, against bug infestation. Its phytochemicals develop the color, the odor. So the plant just naturally develops these phytochemicals. And it's interesting, the more pressure that the plant has had to survive under, the more it has to develop these More stress, thank you. I don't know why I couldn't think of that word. So it has to develop these amazing components of food that we're just now realizing, like broccoli has like 1,000 different phytochemicals, and what do all those things do for us in our body? And it's pretty amazing how they work for our health. So this was just an interesting thing that I read where researchers took endothelial cells, but they cultured them, and then they basically went to them, and they just damaged them. You know, they just tried to onslaught them with whatever they could do to cause DNA damage and whatever oxidation, whatever else they could cause to these endothelial cells. And then they come and act like they're nice guys after that, and they pour blackberry juice over it. You know, I'm speaking to you figuratively, but they added blackberry juice to these cultured endothelial cells. And all of a sudden, they started seeing reversal of all this damage that they had done to these endothelial cells. And they're wondering, what in the world? This is blackberry juice, right? But they knew there's phytochemicals in blackberries that were causing this reversal of the damage. Broccoli is high in a specific phytochemical that has been shown to reduce inflammation and retard the progression of atherosclerosis. So all these things working for us in different ways. Pomegranate juice, this is exciting. Last year, if you were here at camp meeting, you might remember that we talked really small about pomegranate juice, and there was a phytochemical in it, that phytochemical in pomegranates, it's called punicalagins, and it's only found in pomegranates. And we talked about the high priest and what was the fruit at the bottom of his skirt, the pomegranate, and the healing that Christ has for you and I right where it counts, here in our hearts. This was an interesting study in which only 10 patients, but with atherosclerosis and narrowing of the main arteries in the neck, so where the blood is, the oxygen's coming to the brain, these were becoming narrowed, like we saw that picture. they were able to reverse the effects of carotid atherosclerosis by supplementing their diet with pomegranate juice for 1 year. How hard would that be? Carotid artery atherosclerosis decreased by a remarkable 30% in those who consumed pomegranate juice daily. Amazing. Just these simple chemicals that are in these fruits and vegetables, and again, they're producing healing right where it counts, in the lining of our blood vessels. So that picture I showed you that I dubbed Scott and Amundsen, do you know that's actually the same person? It's the same person. So one was before and the other one was after, but the cool thing is that the before picture is to the left and the after picture is to the right. There's redemption, brothers and sisters. It's just stamped on the cells of our body. And I love this picture because God is showing us what is capable if we'd only grab a hold of the wisdom of the Eskimos, as it were. If we'd only grab a hold of it. So this person right here was under Dr. Esselstein's program, and coronary angiograms of the distal left anterior descending artery before and after 32 months of a plant-based diet without cholesterol-lowering medication showing profound improvement. Now, Esselstein uses both. He uses the diet and the cholesterol-lowering medications together, but this person did it without, and they were able to show just what plants are capable of doing. Do you know the Bible says that the weapons of our warfare, they're carnal, but they're mighty through God. They're not carnal. Excuse me, let me quote that better. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're not maybe all the millions of dollars that went into, you know, the development of the pharmaceuticals and the stents, the balloons that go in there and they push across the plaque so that more, you know, oxygen and blood can go through, or where they take a vein from your leg and they put it up here so they can bypass the heart. Those are all very important. They're life-saving. They can be. But the weapons of our warfare that God gave us in food, they're not like that. But they're mighty. They're mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. And we see that evidenced right here, again, stamped upon the blood vessels of our heart. And it's powerful stuff. Dr. Esselstein experienced with his 18 patients, all patients who maintained the diet achieved the cholesterol goal of less than 150, had no recurrent coronary events during the 12 years. At 5 years, angiography was repeated in most cases. By analysis, the occlusion that was taking place in their blood vessels and the progression of their disease had a 70% selective regression, meaning there was improvement. So I just want to encourage you guys today. There's Scott and there's Amundsen. And I just want to encourage you to take a hold of the things that we know. Don't let them just bypass you and for you to think, that's never going to happen to me. We don't know. And it may, even with the best of our efforts, we don't know. It's not necessarily a sign of failure in our lives when things happen to us. But to do our best, to do our part, and I wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
This message was presented at the 2014 Lightbearers Convocation. The theme was Faith to Faith, through which we explored the beautiful message of righteousness by faith. The mission and passion of Lightbearers is publishing, training, and evangelism. To learn how you can partner with us or hear other messages like this, visit us online at lightbearers.org. You can also call us at 1-877-585-1111 or write to us at Lightbearers, 37457 Jasper Lowell Road, Jasper, Oregon 97438. It's through your prayers and generosity that we're able to do what we do. Thank you for listening.